when the world has got you down.
Alzheimer's sucks. It's an equal opportunity disease that chips away at everything we hold dear. And to date, there's no cure. So until there is, we continue to fight with the most powerful tool in our arsenal, love. This is Love Conquers Alls, a real and really positive podcast that takes a deep dive into everything Alzheimer's, the good, the bad, and everything in between. And now, here are your hosts, Susie Singer-Carter and me, Don Preece.
Hi, everybody. I'm Susie Singer-Carter.
And I'm Don Preece, and this is Love Conquers Alls. Hello, Susan.
Hello, Donald. How are you?
I'm swell,
good.
I guess. It's
are
a
you?
Beautiful. Yeah, I think I am. It's a Whoa. It's a lovely day, and
but you didn't go and, golfing today.
I didn't. Yeah. I have a
so
some sort of shoulder
lovely.
Malady. No, I was going to get up nice and early at 6 a.m.
Yeah,
and I did, and I said, "Ooh, I can't swing a club right now."
The grandfather in him is coming out.
Yes, it's like, coming out.
It's creeping in. Out. It's creeping
we
in.
We got to stop that.
Yeah. I keep having
How's yours? How's your day?
I don't golf. My day is great. My day is great. Going back to dance class tomorrow night, so that's good.
Yes,
and,
that's exciting.
Yeah, and let's see what else is going on. I'm doing a documentary, which you know because you helped me edit.
I do. I do. I happen to know a little bit about that.
Yeah.
And honestly, it's going to be powerful.
It's going to be powerful, you guys. It's going to be... It's about a topic that I can't unsee. It's, you know, based on what's going on with our understaffing, which is a crisis in our nursing homes right now. So, and I watched my mom be a victim to it, and a bunch of other people have obviously been a victim to it. And it's just a bad systemic issue. And, you know, I will keep you guys posted on it because I'm not sure how it's going to all play out, but, it's going to be very, we need to make a change. So I'm building a village. And if you have stories that you would like to share with me, you can get a hold of us on any of our platforms on social media. Just let us know if you want to share a story, and we'll see if it's in, you know, the right area.
And,
but I'd love to hear your stories if you're a nurse or a CNA or somebody, you know, on both sides of the aisle in terms of this particular industry, because there's a lot of stories out there and no one's really had a chance to talk about it. So here's your chance to talk about it. Okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And on another note, our short film, My Mom and the Girl, is in the Mom Festival this weekend. And even as we speak, there's the closing,
ceremonies,
at which point they announce, you know, the winners of the festival. We're hoping maybe we might be one of them. We got excellent reviews,
from Spin.
Yeah, Spin. Yeah. They give our film marvelous reviews, and that makes us feel really good.
Yeah.
And it also helps us keep passing on the positive torch that we're trying to set for this this crazy thing called Alzheimer's. So.
Yeah.
So the film
is My Mom
thoughts.
And the Girl, and if you haven't seen it, you should. It's a short film, and it starred Valerie Harper in her last beautiful, amazing performance. So, and we just keep trying to get, you know, more and more people to see it because it resonates, and it's really a lovely look at Alzheimer's. It's really a joyous look at it, if there is one.
Absolutely.
So anyway, we have a fun guest today, Dawn.
We definitely do.
Yeah.
Shall I tell everyone about her?
Yeah, but first let me just tell you why. So if you know, I hate social media so much. Like it takes up so much time, and it's just a glut. It's a glut of like information, and I feel bad having to post, you know, even my stuff on our shows and our movies and things. But, and I know it's a necessary, but this girl, I'm not the kind of person that scrolls all the time, but this girl caught my eyes because she doesn't just write. Like, she doesn't overdo it. It's, but she's there all the time, so she's like a constant, and she's in our she's in our community for dementia care, and you're going to introduce her. But I just thought, you know, if you want a lesson on how to do social media without pissing people off and just really getting your message out there, she's really, really good at it. So, all right, you go, Dawn.
She's found the secret sauce.
Yep.
And I'll tell you a little bit about her. Adria Thompson is her name, and she's a speech-language pathologist, dementia educator, and has over 8 years' experience in working with individuals one-on-one providing speech therapy services. She's the owner of Be Light Care Consulting and has developed a unique dementia training program teaching therapists in 13 states how to increase their creativity, efficiency, and compassion. Her informative and entertaining daily content reaches over 200,000 professional and personal dementia caregivers on social media platforms in a relatable, positive way that makes the condition seem a little less scary and the task of caregiving a little less daunting. She's a powerful, positive force in the caregiving community, and we cannot wait to hear more about her mission. So, without further ado, let's say hello to Adria Thompson. Hello, Adria.
Hi, Adria.
Hi, Susie and Dawn. Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being
thank
here.
Thank you for being here.
See, I didn't lie. 200,000 followers on Instagram.
Yeah.
I'm not surprised because you have a really good demeanor, and your approach to social media is really, really effective. So I'm not surprised, and I'm very, very interested in your speech therapy background and how you incorporated that into dementia. What brought you to dementia? How did you marry those two, you know, practices?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think to answer it, I will first explain what a speech therapist is for some listeners who might not know. You'll hear me say speech language pathologist or speech therapist. It's interchangeable. It means the same thing. But I've been a speech therapist for 8 years, and anyone with a speech that's a speech therapist in the United States has a bachelor's and master's degree. And a lot of people might think of a speech therapist working with children, and that very much is something I could do, but my specialty is working with geriatrics and in the medical field. So in the realm of speech therapy with adults, we help people with three things. That's communication, swallowing, and cognition. So communication is anything like, of course, expressing yourself verbally, but also in writing, and then also understanding the speech or reading something from a page, so comprehension from language as well. Mm. And then also the actual production of speech, so voice quality or fluency, like if someone stutters, for example. And then swallowing is anybody who has a swallowing disorder is considered to have dysphagia. Right. And so that can be difficulty anywhere from chewing food all the way down to it going down the wrong way. So we are specialists in that area. And then as far as cognition goes, that's all areas of thinking. So memory, but also attention, reasoning, problem solving, planning, and organizing thoughts. So with that description, you can kind of see where dementia falls into that, because for individuals with dementia, they often have deficits in all of those areas. They lose their ability to communicate effectively, and they a lot of times start having difficulty chewing and swallowing. And of course, we know that their cognition is affected because, you know, short-term memory loss, reasoning, all of that is one of the first symptoms that we see. So as a speech therapist, in my role, I would provide one-on-one services to anyone who has needs in those areas. And a large part of any speech therapist caseload that works in a nursing home or in assisted living are individuals with dementia. And it's not everyone's cup of tea, but it is my passion and definitely my specialty.
And how did you get in? Why are you passionate about it? I'm interested to know.
You know, and it's interesting because in grad school, I thought I wanted to work with kids, and I was really drawn to children with more severe disabilities. And I've always kind of been a person that really likes a challenging case. And so when I got out of grad school, I was just doing different interviews, getting experience out in the real world. And I interviewed with a nursing home and I got a good offer. And I just thought, well, I can do this for a little while. And I just fell in love with it. There's really no like specific story as to how it happened. I just really realized that this is where I'm supposed to be. And but the same kind of thing happened where that I really like the most severe cases in this population as well. And typically that is with individuals with dementia. They are the most challenging to care for, and you know, their issues are so complex. Yes. And they're not always able to participate in solving those problems for themselves. Right. So I love the ability to like be a detective and figure out what might be going on.
Oh my God, you are so needed. And I have experience, firsthand experience. I am so excited to talk to you about this. I really am. And I think it's so, so important for people to understand what you're saying, because especially like dysphagia, which comes in, you know, later stages of Alzheimer's, right? And there's a lot of different schools of thought on it. And there's also, it plays into an issue that I'm, it's going to, that plays a big part in our documentary too, because, which I'll get to in a second, but I wanted to ask you, so you just decided this is your focus is dementia. And then what I noticed in your videos, your daily videos with really good information, and you seem very young, and you seem you've been young. You've 8 years sounds like a long time, but it's really not in the scheme of things. And you are very astute, and more astute than most doctors that I've worked with my mother, who had Alzheimer's for 16 years, and most of the medical industry doesn't understand it like you do. You have a really good understanding of how to communicate, how to make, you know, keep it positive, and, you know, and be productive within
in practical, because it's very practical.
Yeah.
It's very what you need to literally move on every day, as opposed to, you know, more complicated or you know, you've really made it in this palatable form that just really helps immediately. It's like these are actual tools you can use.
Well, I mean, you're going to save people lots of years, because I learned all that by rote, right? So I had to learn how to do that, because I didn't know anybody with Alzheimer's until my mom. So I would, you know, it was all trial and error. And because I was so close with her, I could figure out what worked and what didn't work, and just go with my intuition and also just my compassion and my love for her. But not everybody has that, nor do they have time. So how did you come up with all this terrific approach?
Yeah, I appreciate your kind words. I feel like I'm very much living and found like a way to make my job, my career, be everything that is my strengths. Because I look back, even before I had any interest in dementia, back like in high school, I would, after calculus class, I would go to my friend's house, and I was always the one that would stand at this whiteboard that my friend had, and I would re-explain these complicated concepts in a more simple way. And then, you know, in college, I look back and I was like leading Bible studies and like taking really complex ideas and breaking it down in simple ways. And that was just something that I naturally felt like I could do and that I really enjoyed. And so with dementia, I feel like my strengths are very much being used in that area, taking really complex ideas in a really simple and relatable way. And it is so important for me. I love that you said the word like practical, because that is my biggest goal, is to make all of this information very practical. You can watch one of my videos and then turn around and implement it immediately, understanding not only what might work, but why it might work too. And I think that that's really important. And also, it might surprise people to know that I'm an introvert, and I do not like to be the center of attention. So videos do well for me, because it's the audience is my phone. I don't really have the capacity, nor do I want to have the capacity, to understand how many people are watching my videos. But also, I'm not a super emotional person. And so it's easy for me to give this information in a very like non-dramatic way, because I think when we start involving emotion, it begins to get really complicated. And so if I can just kind of take a step back and give you a big big bird's eye view of what might be going on and allow on my own, my followers to process that in whatever way they need to. That's my goal.
Right. I agree with you. I mean, that's the thing that I appreciate about your videos is that, you know, and I'm going to just be bold and say that this community is, you know, is a fantastic community, but there's also, you're always going to find in different communities, people that are going to exploit it or, you know, use it for different purposes. You know, it's just the way it's part of business. It's part of, you know, humanity. And, you know, you don't lead with your ego. There's not a lot of ego going on there. And yet you're really, disarming too. It's not like it's not clinical. You're approachable. And so that's the good combination. Like you're an approachable human being who I get that you're not emotional. I get that you're very even keeled. It comes across. And I pick that up. Like, you know, I'm an emotional person, but I certainly, like, I don't like to do, and I'm an actress. I'm a director. I'm a writer, but I work with the camera all the time, but I don't really like to like throw my personal feelings out there unless I feel like it's so important and that by doing that, it's going to make change. And that's the only reason why I would ever do it.
Yeah. And I had to set boundaries really early on for myself about how I was going to communicate about dementia. It's very important to me that anytime that I demonstrate something that I'm not mocking or making fun of or even just imitating someone with dementia in an exaggerated way, because I think that there's enough stigma out there about how someone with dementia might appear. And so my husband helps me with some of my videos. He's a great sport, but I always tell him to not be silly with it, just to be very straightforward, because the focus needs to be on me and my approach and what I'm doing. And so I think that sometimes people don't think that through. But I want to bring dignity back to dementia. And, you know, my name, Be Light, is kind of twofold. I want to bring light as far as illuminating this disease and helping people understand it. But I also want the subject to be light. I want it to be lighthearted. I want to take the stress and the burden off of it. So if I can bring light in either capacity, that's what it's all about.
It's interesting. I think that, you know, from what I've heard, you haven't had a personal connection, like a family connection with somebody with dementia. Is that correct?
I actually have a grandmother with dementia. Yeah. So I don't talk about it a lot, but like in my video, but I'm willing to talk about it in general because, you know, once again, I want to respect her and her situation, but I do understand it from a personal and professional point of view. But my grandmother didn't get dementia until just a few years ago, so it was well into my career already. So I was able to kind of help navigate the family through that process.
Do you think that that's affected, meaning that you didn't have it prior to you starting and then suddenly it came into your life? Has that affected the way you communicate or the type of communication that you've been doing? Or have you been able to kind of compartmentalize that?
It's been an interesting experience because even though dementia is my specialty and I spend all day long talking about it, when she started showing signs, I found myself even being a little bit in denial of like, oh, like she's just getting older and getting ornery, or, you know, and so it was an interesting experience for me. It helped me relate more to the caregivers that I talk with about the process that they go through. And I'm someone who knows everything about, you know, not really, but I know so much about this disease. And so it's helped me be more relatable in that way. It's also really helped me see my mom through this process.
I want to get into something a little bit more on the clinical side of this, because, you know, my mom, I just passed away last month from Alzheimer's. And so I went through the whole journey with her, and the last 6 months were incredibly intense. And, you know, and a lot of it had to do with understaffing and the COVID situation, and a lot of short shrifting because they had to. And, you know, not everybody has a hands-on caregiver that really gets it and is really intuitive, you know, and I will say that with not tooting my own horn, but I just am. And My mom ended up being diagnosed with dysphagia before she had even seen a speech therapist. She had gone into the hospital and had received a G-tube, which is a feeding tube through the stomach, because she had to be intubated, and it was only supposed to be temporary because my mom was eating fine before. There wasn't a problem with that, and eating was her life, okay? So when she got out of the hospital, the nursing home didn't want to have the feeding tube removed, and then also wouldn't feed her orally because they said she was going to aspirate. I had already been having her drink, and I know that she was swallowing perfectly. She was not aspirating, but it became the lesser of two evils for them because it freed them up of time.
First of all, I'm really sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
For your mother and what she experienced.
Thank you.
Were they wanting to use her feeding tube for nutrition? Okay.
Yes.
And she didn't need it.
It's a really big challenge for swallowing disorders inside of nursing homes that I have faced myself as a speech therapist. And that's because there's a lot of liability to nursing homes when someone does have trouble swallowing. And so there are a lot of different methods and policies that exist in different states and across different companies, nursing home companies. So, for example, sometimes when I've worked in a nursing home and I am working with someone with dementia who inevitably loses their ability to swallow, which will happen if someone lives long enough, then we'll kind of come in that situation where they are not safe to swallow, which just means that food or drink, there's a large percentage of the chance that it's going to go down into their lungs, which could cause pneumonia, which could then cause their death. Or it could obstruct their airway completely, which is just like a normal choking episode you might imagine, and once again cause their death. And so when any kind of swallowing problem occurs and there is not a clear path for a speech therapist to say, yes, this is 100% chance that they are going to be able to eat and drink perfectly without any problems, then there is a level of liability for the place. So there is something that's called silent aspiration, where someone can have food or drink go down the wrong way and show no clinical signs. And some clinical signs that we might look for are coughing, throat clearing, or a wet, gurgly voice. So someone can have something go down the wrong way without any of the signs. And so that's what we consider silent aspiration. So I'm not sure, of course, what the specific situation was for your mom, but it is possible that the preference of the facility is that they use a G-tube because it doesn't carry the risk of choking and aspiration. But interestingly, actually, G-tubes still carry a pretty big risk of aspiration because it can cause reflux. It can come back up in the throat and then be aspirated there. So it's not completely a foolproof method either.
Exactly. And I brought that to their attention. And, you know, and at some point you have to decide what is quality of life as opposed to keeping somebody alive. And my mother wasn't allowed to have any liquid oral gratification, and that is torture. Because she was very much cognizant and up relating and interpersonally and very much was wanting to. And I had to finally get them to have a speech therapist come in, and the speech therapist watched me give her liquid, and she said, well, you're doing a good job. I'll let you do it, but nobody else. But when she tested her, you know, she put her finger on her throat, and my mom was not going to swallow with her finger there. So, you know, I think we have to look at people as individuals and say, what's their base for swallowing? My mom is the kind of person that goes, then she's going to swallow because she's going to taste it first. Always done that. Yeah.
I mean, you might have seen me cringe when you said that she put her hand on her throat, because the only way that we can determine if aspiration is occurring is if we do an instrumental study, and there's two of those. One is called a modified barium swallow, which is where someone sits in front of an x-ray machine and eats and drinks things that are coated in barium. So we can watch in the x-ray that it goes down the right way. And the other instrumental study that we can do is called a FEES, or a fiber optic endoscopic evaluation of swallow, which is where you run a camera on a scope through someone's nose, and it dangles in the back of their throat, and then we watch them eat or drink, and we can see if it's going down the tube that goes to the stomach or the tube that goes to the lungs. And so those are the only two ways that we know with certainty if aspiration occurs. So any kind of listening to swallow or feeling for a swallow, that's just as good as a random guess, to be honest.
Love it.
And
I love hearing this.
There is a huge shift in speech therapy right now of basically like some of the old school methods of listening to a swallow with a stethoscope and holding your hand on someone's throat. We are moving away from that because there's the evidence of determining if someone is aspirating is not there. And so there is, in the speech therapy world, a huge movement right now to stop telling that people can't eat or drink because we think that they're swallowing. Oh. It's way too big of a decision. And so I want to encourage you to know that there is, on that, on our side of things, there is a big push for that. But as far as where that is in the medical community at large, I'm sure that there's still a lot of mistakes that are being made.
It's really important, and it's so good to hear that, Adria, because it's actually so distressing to watch someone that you love, you know, and you know, you can talk about this because we're, you know, and I don't want to be negative, but I want to be honest about what happens in this situation with someone doesn't get oral gratification. First of all, their will to live is going to go down, which happened to my mom, because there's nothing to do. It's not, you know, it that's part of socializing. It's part of one of the senses that you still have left as someone with dementia, and it's an enjoyable experience, right? So she was stolen, you know, she was robbed of that. And then, you know, on a physical level, the mouth dries out and there's like mucus that forms that gets solid, that gets stuck in the back of their throat and on the top of their roof of their mouth, and it's distressing, and they can choke on that too, and it's awful. It's awful, guys.
And that's what she was struggling with when you would, because you would feed her with a sponge.
They let me feed her with a sponge and like let her suck on it.
And she would just take her time and then swallow it. But the stuff she was really having problems was what was, because the only time that happens when Susie was there doing it, and she was there every day doing it, but the staff wouldn't. So in between, all this stuff was building up, and that's the stuff she was having, struggling, breathing and choking and coughing. That for some reason is not a liability, and that makes no sense, does it?
It doesn't. And I'm so sorry for your experience, and because I know exactly what you're talking about. I have myself been the ones to peel the sheet of dried mucus off of someone's hard palate in their mouth because they have gone without any kind of something to drink. And you know, there is a time and place where someone is placed on what we call NPO, or means no food or drink.
Right.
This might be because they've had a stroke and they have, this is the best example. When someone has had a stroke, sometimes they lose their ability to swallow. And a lot of times at this point, they will place a G-tube. But after a stroke, there is a huge percentage chance that they are going to restore that ability. Stroke recovery is well documented. And so there might be a time where we need to keep someone NPO, that they eat through a feeding tube while we are working on recovering their swallow ability.
Yes, yes.
But when someone loses their ability because of a neurological degenerative disease, which we know is going to continue to get worse until the day they die, a G-tube is usually not indicated because there is no end point to that. There's no, oh, okay, when she recovers, then we will transition. We have to be realistic. It's downhill when you have dementia for all things. And so when the time comes that that is part of the conversation, a speech therapist especially needs to be the one leading the conversation of what are your goals? What are your goals for this person, with this patient, you know, for yourself if you are the patient? Because policies inside of nursing homes make it really tough for us, and I've personally experienced this myself, and I alluded to this earlier, but if I determine that someone is at a high risk of aspiration, hopefully because I've actually done an instrumental study and I've seen it with my own eyes and not because I guessed, then I need to have a conversation with the family and say, okay, here's the situation. This person is aspirating and they're likely not going to recover those abilities. We can try, but because of their degenerative nature of their disease, it's probably not going to happen. And so here, let's have a conversation about how we move forward. Do you want them to just eat or drink whatever they want and know that there is a high risk that they could get choked? Or do we want to modify their diet a little bit? We want to give them food that is a little bit safer for them. We might make it softer so that they're not necessarily having like the episode of choking where their airway is completely occluded, right? Mm-hmm. So we can, there's wiggle room. There should be wiggle room. But a lot of policies in nursing homes say if there's any indication that aspiration could happen, they're either NPO, yep, or sometimes the rule is they have to go hospice.
They did that with my
because
mom.
Because hospice allows for a lot more freedom and liberality to things in general, but you know, if some of those decisions or some of those things have already happened, then, you know, they're kind of stuck too. So it's really, really messy. But just like, okay, if someone's 90 years old and they get a cancer diagnosis, someone needs to, like, they need to have the ability to say, I understand I have this disease and it could lead to my death, but I'm going to say that I do not want treatment. Swallowing should be a similar conversation. I understand I have this condition, but I don't want the treatment of a D-tube and NPO. I want to live out my life knowing that I'm going to die someday. So it's really complicated. There's a lot of layers. And nobody's doing it really well right
Adria,
now.
Adria, first of all, I love you so much because what you're saying resonates so much for me. I wish I knew you 2 months ago. But what you're saying is so on point and so correct as far as I'm concerned, because it makes, I mean, if your person, like Adria said, is coming to the finish line and we know it, who is going to enjoy their life if they're awake? I'm not saying if they have a stroke and they're unconscious. My mom was awake and kissing and snuggling and smiling and laughing. And she, every time I gave her the sponge to suck on, she'd go, like that. So she wanted to.
And it woke her up.
And it woke her up.
Every time you put that sponge in her mouth, she, you know, she'd be very lethargic. The second that sponge went in her mouth, she woke up.
It was like she was alive.
Because she had some sense, because most of her other senses were very much diminished. That one she could still enjoy. And that was like her one thing. And yet the decision, even in hospice, was nobody, she's getting nothing.
Nothing.
Then finally, after Susie pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed, they said, okay, Susie, only you.
Right.
But our staff is not going to do it. And that makes no sense, especially in hospice.
And what's interesting is that research is showing right now that pneumonia is more likely for someone who has poor oral care, which means basically a dirty mouth, even than someone who is aspirating. So aspiration is not the highest indication for pneumonia, for aspiration pneumonia. It is having a bacteria in your mouth, because pneumonia is just bacteria in your lungs. Your lungs are made only for air.
Exactly.
And so when anything else goes into your lungs, then your immune system starts to attack it. And that's what pneumonia is, basically. And so if we have a mouth and a whole throat full of phlegm and bacteria from no one cleaning, no water coming in and out, then it is like a feast time for bacteria.
It's ripe. Adria, you're so right. Listen to me, listeners, I'm telling you, it's so important to be, we need to make changes in this, because I literally, and you know, even with the one time I got to see the speech therapist, this was like, you know, well into after she was in hospice, and she said, I will order oral care 3 times a day. Well, first of all, it didn't happen 3 times a day. I can promise you that. And second of all, until I, you know, banged the drum as hard as I could, did she get any oral care at all? And so, you know, and by the way, she died, you know, pneumonia was part of the what she died from. Okay, so that, what you're saying resonates for me, that, you know, why torture somebody and not let them have, you know, at least a quality, some quality of life on their last, you know, weeks, months, whatever it is, and you know, and have that quality be dictated by policy that makes no sense and is based on, you know, it's based on liability, like you said, on the bottom line, basically. And that's so unfair. It's so unfair because it really reflects how we marginalize our older population, and in particular, our older
and
population.
Susie even said, I'll
dementia.
Sign a waiver. I will sign a waiver. I'll let your staff do this, and I will not hold you responsible. They wouldn't even consider it. Would not.
Because every time she went back into the hospital, which she bounced back and forth 6 times since January, she still had pneumonia, whether she had, and she wasn't drinking. So it wasn't that.
Right. They didn't eliminate the risk.
And the G-tube does.
Yeah, they didn't eliminate pneumonia from all this, you know, all these policies. It mm-hmm. still was happening.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, but that comes down to checking off the boxes. Which one are they liable for, and which one aren't they liable for? And that's why we need to make the system, the Medicare system, the Medi-Cal system, aware of what actually causes these things. Like you saying bad oral care can cause that. We all know that even bad oral care can give people mm-hmm. heart attacks, right? Yeah. That's why you take antibiotics before you have some people before they have their teeth cleaned.
Yeah, my grandmother had an infection in her mouth, and it traveled to her spine and set up in her back. I mean, oral care is extremely important, and speech therapists have been ringing this bell for years saying, I mean, we can decrease rehospitalization rates. If we want to talk about numbers and liability for nursing homes, we can decrease rehospitalization rates, decrease pneumonia rates if we just brush their teeth. And we'll have less modified diets because people will keep their teeth longer. I mean, the benefits are endless, but it's like, oh, we don't have time for that. And, you know, it's terrible.
It's extraordinary what they have time for, though. Like, it's like we need to prioritize what is the priority. Right, so we need to redo the formulary for what really is going to make the quality of life or enhance it, really, right? I mean, that's what the goal is. Otherwise, why are we keeping people alive? There's no reason to, other than making other people rich. Sorry, I'm on a soapbox. Sorry, guys.
So what? And it's counterintuitive, as you were saying. It seems so counterintuitive because it's causing more care needs as opposed to being preventative about it just by doing some fairly simple stuff, you know, the understaffing and things like that, or just, you know, poor staffing is the root of it. So what, you know, you said, you know, speech therapists have been banging the drum for a year. So how do we bang a bigger drum? You know, Susie's about to do that with a documentary.
Yes.
And, you know, what have you discussed with other speech therapists? Like, what can we do to change this?
Yeah, especially in acute care, in hospitals, there are a lot of speech therapists that are putting together programs, putting together lots of research and presenting these to hospital executives of, here's what research is showing us about the importance of oral care and this, like, we need to implement this. And there is change that is happening across the country. But I think the problem with nursing homes is that those executives are not they don't have an office in the building, right? They are somewhere else. So I don't know. I don't know where the change, how the change can happen, because I know from myself, whether it be a dementia program or an oral care program, when I bring this up to nursing home administrators, we don't have it in the budget. We don't have the staff, right? And so I don't know personally what the answer is, but I'm willing to be on board with it. I'm willing to be a part of it if someone can figure it out.
I really boned up on everything I could, and I knew so much about this area. I started really getting knowledgeable on it, and I said there's other tests that we can take that required like the barium and things like that. And they said same thing. I'd have to pay for that. They wouldn't arrange for it. It's not part of what Medicare is going to cover. And that would be an outside cost. And so, which seems so, like Dawn said, counterintuitive, because, you know, they're trying to mitigate their costs, but then
they're
by not doing
the cost.
It,
yeah.
It's increasing their costs.
And I think this problem exists for people, other diagnoses, like people who have had strokes, people who have ALS, people who have degenerative disorders that, whether it be, you know, whatever it might be, there, this problem exists. But I think that it exists more so in the dementia world, because individuals with dementia are not able to advocate for themselves. We can't look at the person and say, what do you want? Do you want a feeding tube?
So I have a question for you. And again, back to the G-tube and aspiration, which like you said, it carries a high risk of aspiration as well. And how does somebody know when somebody, a resident or a patient, is aspirating from a G-tube? Like, is that a silent aspiration?
It can be. It can be a silent aspiration where it is just going into the lungs and there's no clinical signs, there's no coughing, there's no wet voice or anything like that. But we could see signs from vomiting. So basically, if someone is aspirating from a G-tube, it's some level of reflux. And reflux just means that contents in the stomach is coming back up the esophagus, which is the tube that goes there, and goes into the tube that goes down to our lungs. And so someone might cough. They might not show any signs. It's kind of how you experience heartburn. That kind of feeling, someone might feel it, but once again, if they have dementia, they might not be able to tell you. And so individuals with dementia, especially since that's a lot of what we talk about, it's very hard to tell.
I find that very interesting. And I think that it's something that we need to really take a look at, because, you know, if you're going to restrict oral gratification because of aspiration and the possibility of silently aspirating, there, like you said, a G-tube feeding carries pretty much the same risk, if not more, because unless they regurgitate, you're not going to know if that's happening. And at one point I went into the facility that my mom was at, and I noticed that the flow rate of her G-tube was doubled. And so I went and talked to the charge nurse. It was like 10 at night, and finally the charge nurse came and said, oh no, I would never, that couldn't happen. And then she looked at it, she said, oh yeah, it's supposed to be at 60, not 120. And so anyway, it's a long story, but she stopped it. And then I talked, and then I had called, the triage nurse at night, because from the hospice, and she said that she actually said she could have vomited, and that would have been, you know, a very horrendous situation in terms of aspirating. And so, you know, that's when I first learned about it and went and did a deep dive on it, on the possibility of that. And I find it interesting that that is not on the list of high liability. And like, how, I'm wondering if that's a way, you know, if, how can we get that situation to be in everyone's purview as much as oral gratification is? Do you, Am I making sense, Dawn and Andrea?
Yes. So we can decrease the risk of aspiration from a G-tube by keeping the head of the bed up and keeping them like sitting up rather than laying flat. But, and we do this also with people who eat orally, right? If they're eating, we want to make sure that they're sitting up. But also, if someone has a tendency towards GERD or gastric esophageal reflux, a lot of people do, like even neurotypical people, right? We all have acid reflux or heartburn to some degree. So some people are more prone to it than others. And people who are prone to it, we will always recommend to not lay down flat unless it's 30 minutes after you've eaten a meal, because we want to give it time to start to digest. The issue, though, is with people on G-tubes is that it's not obvious from our eyes that they are eating, right? It can be pumping into their stomach, and we don't know. And so staff, it would require them, even the aides, to be educated to know when the pump is on, how long it's been off, and to avoid laying them flat. And we might think that's not that big of a deal. How often does that happen? Well, if you care for someone with dementia or someone who is bedbound, essentially, we have to lay them flat every time we change them, right? We change their clothes, we change their undergarments. And so an aide might be having the most wonderful intentions going in, changing them, you know, and having a great approach, but they might miss the step of checking that pump and seeing, is it on? Because if it's on, or if it's been on in the last 30 minutes, we do not need to lay them down. And so that is not trained. I mean, yeah. And it's very overlooked, right? Yeah. And so they might have good intentions to clean them up, to do all kinds of good things and scoot them up in bed. But that carries a risk.
And that's, you know, because and your mom, they thought it was on for 5 hours at that rate, at that double rate. So, you know, during that time, she was probably laid flat a couple times. They turning her over to one side or the other because she had a bed sore, all these things. So that comes with education. Yes. That's really what you're doing, because you don't only, you know, educate the family member, the caregiver, you're also educating the professionals.
Yes.
So how, again, we keep asking, how do we get this out there? How do we get this education out to the masses of professionals? Because this is like everything. This is the crux of knowledge is the crux of everything when it comes to this type of care. And why is it so overlooked? And what you're doing something about it, but you know, we got to get it out to everybody.
I think the approach that's taken a lot of times is telling someone what to do without telling them why. And I think that is a missing piece a lot of times. And so aides, we don't want to throw them under the bus, but typically that their job is to provide most of the one-on-one care, the daily care, changing them, feeding them, those kind of things. And largely, of course, they are educated to some degree. In some assisted livings, they are not certified, though. They had just been trained on orientation day and the basics of caring for someone. But they might have had a past history in being a waitress. They don't have any nursing care. Someone who's a certified nursing assistant will have some training, of course. But do they understand the complexity of dysphagia and aspiration? I'm sure they don't. And so when we tell, I know, once again, like from experience, when I tell an aide, hey, don't lay them down during their G-tube feedings, you need to make sure that they stay up for at least 30 minutes afterwards, I would need you to clean their mouth really well, we want to make sure that we, if they have teeth, that we actually use a toothbrush and not just a sponge. Sponges are okay for people maybe who don't have any teeth at all, but if they have teeth, we need to be in there with a brush and cleaning. If they are unable to spit, we need to have a suction device nearby so that we can suction that out of their mouth. All the details, right? We tell them that all the time, but they just see it as, so much more to do, to add to my list, mm-hmm. all these things that I have to do. And they, maybe I'm giving some people probably more benefit, but maybe if they understood why, it might help. At least it might make them feel more compelled to complete those tasks rather than if they're just told to. So I think education is really important.
Right on.
And I think, you know, and I always tell people this, like I told this to a cook in one of the kitchens of the place I worked in. We were having issues back and forth, and this is just the kind of person I am. But I kind of just stopped the conversation at one point because we kept going in circles. And I said, listen, I just need to know, is this mistake that your kitchen made, is this a mistake out of ignorance? Did you not know any better? Or was this negligence? Like, if this is ignorance, I can work with that. What do I need to do? Let's do a training. Let's put together a day. I will make a PowerPoint. I can handle that. If it's negligence, if you know what you're supposed to do and why it's important and you're just not doing it, that's not my job. Like, we need to go higher up and we need to deal with this from your boss, right? Like, I'm not your boss. I need to deal with this in a different way. And I think that is, I've kind of used that terminology before of with other caregivers and other, medical professionals, is is this issue out of ignorance or out of negligence? Because we're going to deal with that two completely different ways.
Can I interject and say, I love that approach. However, when the nurse that was remiss to check what the flow rate should have been at, it was her first time alone on the floor. She was very nervous and she felt really bad about the whole thing. It's not her fault. Her training was not, it wasn't good enough. It wasn't good enough. And so.
And they admitted that. They admitted that.
They
later,
said it's a training problem.
It was a training issue.
But the thing is that a training issue, and she didn't know better. She obviously didn't know better. And she's not the kind of person that would have, she didn't have instinct on it. She's by the book.
And she was the charge nurse, by the way,
it was her first time on the floor alone. So she, you can definitely say but how do you differentiate between what is, you don't know better and negligence? Because not knowing better
is
negligence because not for the people doing it, but for the people running the show, because the people running the show need to make sure that everybody understands the importance of what they're doing.
Yeah. And ownership should be taken place either way. Like you said, they're both a problem. Not one is not necessarily better than the other. I think probably from a medical educating standpoint, I'm more comfortable with one than the other because I know that it's my job to help with educating.
That makes sense.
But as a family member, it doesn't matter, right? Like, mm-hmm. from your point of view, it doesn't matter if they didn't know better or if they knew better and did it anyway, because the outcome is the same. The outcome was that your mom was injured, right? She was made uncomfortable. She was put at a high risk. So that's a problem. And I think, medical mistakes happen on every level, every day. And it carries a very difficult consequence.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
But this is systemic because if you're saying you are putting people there, some of them are certified, some of them are not. Some was just a hairdresser 2 days ago, and because of staffing issues, we're hiring them, and they're still taken care of. It's shocking because I don't think they're just hiring lifeguards at the beach without certifying them just because they need somebody up on the tower. No, you have to be trained. And that should be anyone who's on that floor and anyone who deals with somebody in those facilities should be fully trained, certified. And so we mitigate the possibilities of this happening. There's still going to be problems, as you say, at any level. But the fact that we have the people who are literally the hands-on people not knowing what they're doing is shocking. It's disturbing. And that's the crux of this issue. And that's what needs to be changed.
A lot of what we talked about comes down to the bottom line, and it comes down to making money, running a business, those kind of things. But we can use that, I think, to our advantage if we use it in the right way, in the fact that if we pay these aides better, then they're going to be more motivated to be good. We're going to have more competition when we go to hire. We're not going to be desperate to get anyone off the street, mm-hmm. because the reality is, especially during COVID, during like when I was working inside facilities, right when things started opening back up, a lot of people started hiring again. An aide could go work in a memory care and get, you know, harassed and beat up, for without better terms, from some of the patients, right? That's just kind of the nature of the disease sometimes. But they can have this really hard emotionally and physical job, or they could go down the street and work at, you know, the local bar and get paid the same exact thing and not experience that. And so I know, just as a speech therapist too, another part of this is I never have gotten a raise. The only time I've ever increased my salary is by moving jobs and negotiating when I'm hired. So a lot of medical professions, there is not any motivation for someone to be better at their job. So as a speech therapist, I'm pursuing a lot of continuing education in dementia because I want to be better, because I started my own business and there is motivation there. But as a speech therapist in the buildings I was working in, if I was a really great speech therapist or a really terrible one, I would still have my job and I'd still be paid the same. And so I think, you know, if we want to talk about healthcare being a business, we can talk about that too. Because I think that there's ways that we can kind of manipulate the system in a better way on that side of things too. So it's complicated. It's a really complicated scenario.
I really appreciate that, Adria. And I think that I would love to have you back for a part two and talk about those ways. Because, I mean, we have so much information that we just laid out that I think is new information for most people. Because it was new for me. You know, I didn't really, this all hit me in January. And I was fighting for my mother's life, basically. I literally was fighting for her to have dignity and to be comfortable and to be a human being. Just to be treated like a human being and not a statistic. You know, and to look at her, and I cannot tell you how many times I said to them, this is a woman. This is a human being that I love. This is a woman who's dynamic and has had an amazing life. You can't just write her off. It's not fair.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
I'm so sorry.
You know, oh, thank you. Thank you. I'm sorry too. And I think, you know, I always try to take situations that have been handed me and make something positive out of it. And if it's changing, if I can make a change, then that's what I'm going to do. Because like I started this conversation, I just saw things that I can't unsee and I can't keep it to myself.
And I think that that's what you're doing, Adria. Also, you are taking that and you're saying, I'm not just going to stand by. I have knowledge. I'm going to share it. And that's what you do every single day on your social media posts, on Instagram and TikTok. And that's, knowledge is everything. If what we do with it, that's a whole nother thing, but you got to start with, you know, getting that information out, and thank you for doing what you're doing. And I think a lot of people are going to thank you because you literally can change somebody's entire life with one little bit of information.
Yeah.
You know, whether it be incontinence or, you know, or just communication or all those things. And those are the things that you're practically giving every single day. And thank you for doing that. Is that
definitely
what is the most satisfying thing about doing what you're doing?
I get around 40 messages a day of people either asking questions, but most of them just thanking me. And it's such an honor. Like, it's such an honor. This is the best I've cracked the code of the perfect job, owning my own business, doing this, because I feel so much purpose in this. And like I said, I feel like I'm very much in my strengths, and I am just so honored to walk alongside people down this path that's typically dark and scary, to make it not so mysterious, not so heavy. And it's just so much fun for me. So I'm glad that it's led me to conversations like this. I've met so many awesome people, and I just feel like I can't help but just feel hope that things are getting better. You know, we can address all of these concerns and all of these problematic things, and I think that in doing so we can push forward and make change.
Good. I love hearing that, and I want to make change with you. And I appreciate that you are very stable and you don't work from your emotions, and I am heart-centered and I work from my emotions, but I think that our village needs all of that, right?
Absolutely.
And you know, and that's why we center on love, and which is why, Dawn, why do we do that?
We do that, and you know why? Because love is powerful, and love is contagious, and love conquers alls. And we so thank everyone for being here today. We thank you, Adria. We're going to put up all your contact information, and we hope everyone follows you on Instagram and TikTok. And I hope everyone follows us along the way. And again, we thank you all for being here. We will see you next time.
Yes, bye, everybody.